From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Joyce Vance.
How are you, Joyce? Missed you last week.
I know. I was sorry to be out, but it was a great guest-hosted episode of the podcast.
Mr. Carlin does a good job. Should we get right into it? Unless you have something else on your mind?
I think we should. It is one of those weeks where this is all I'm thinking about.
So we're going to talk about the Mar-a-Lago document case. Lots of roiling speculation that there could be a charge as soon as this week. Just please, God, don't let it be between the time we record this and the time it drops Tuesday evening, because stuff like that happens to us. And then we're going to talk about ChatGPT and its use in the courtroom and in legal brief writing, which I'm also very excited to talk about. Everyone has been asking questions about that. So first, the Mar-a-Lago document. So there's been obviously an indictment in Manhattan by the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg. Lots of focus on the Mar-a-Lago documents. Jack Smith, the special counsel, has not talked to the press, has not, to my knowledge, leaked any information at all about the case, although some information trickles out, speaks through his work. Grand jury has been active. Witnesses have been talked to. Reporting suggests that evidence from witnesses is basically at its end. And people are predicting outright, I don't know why they do this, because people have been proven wrong so many times, including yours truly. People are predicting outright an indictment on obstruction and perhaps other counts this week. And one of the reasons people are saying that, and let's maybe start with this, is that some of Trump's lawyers met with lawyers from the Justice Department Monday, reportedly for up to 2 hours. They were photographed and videotaped coming out of the Justice Department building that you and I know very well. And I guess the first question people have is, what does that mean? What is that meeting like? What is the point of the meeting? What does that say about timing? Maybe let's do that last question first, Joyce, and I have some views as well. What does the fact of that meeting tell you about the timing of a potential decision about a charge?
In a case like this, I think that that's a very late stage step for the lawyers to go in. I mean, the only reason that you have this meeting is because you've been advised that your client is going to be indicted. If there's not going to be an indictment, there is no need to meet. And so this suggests to me that indictments either of the former president or maybe of some of the folks around him are, dare I use the word, imminent?
So I don't know if it's necessarily the case generally. It may be true here that the fact of a meeting means a decision to indict has been made. And particularly in this case, I think there's evidence to suggest that the meeting was requested by Trump's lawyer. So there were times when I was a U.S. attorney where certainly I think the general rule was it was a known investigation. It was not covert. It was rather overt. And there was some understanding on the part of the target and his lawyers that we were moving towards an indictment. And maybe at some point we would say, yeah, we're intending, or, you know, our current thinking is we're going to indict. Do you want an opportunity to come in? And those were usually in white collar cases because you want to keep an open mind and you want to make sure that you understand everything that you're supposed to understand. And maybe you've missed something in the law or the facts. And as a courtesy, you invite the defense lawyers in to make a presentation. And I attended many such presentations. In most instances, we had decided to indict and our mind was not changed. There were a couple of instances in which our mind was not made up. We had a lien. I remember one case in particular where the lawyers came in and did a very, very, very thorough and rigorous and fair presentation, after which we decided not to indict. So it happens both ways. What's interesting to me is all the speculation about who attended. Now, I don't know if the reporting is correct, but the newspaper reports suggest that the Attorney General himself, Merrick Garland, was not at the meeting. And Lisa Monaco, the Deputy Attorney General, was also not at the meeting. But that Jack Smith, the special counsel, was at the meeting, and that makes sense because he has some amount of autonomy as a special counsel. Does it say anything to you that neither, if it's true, that neither the AG or the Deputy AG were at the meeting?
You know, I think it's interesting. There was also reporting that suggests that a high-level official in the Deputy Attorney General's office, who's been coordinating with others of the special counsels, the Durham investigation, Hunter's laptop, all that stuff, was present. So, you know, there was someone there. I think you do this sort of a meeting for exactly the reasons that you identify. And maybe you don't need to have the attorney general or the deputy there, especially because this is the special counsel's investigation. And the decision about whether or not to indict, at least in the first instance, belongs to him. But it makes sense to me that this meeting happened. There were some people who seemed offended by it. For me, both as a line prosecutor, when I would always meet with a defense lawyer who wanted to talk about their case, we have very collegial relationships with the defense bar here, and it was not at all unusual to do that. But as the U.S. attorney, any time that a lawyer wanted to come in and make a case that we should not indict once that decision had been made or when we were close, I thought it made sense to listen to them because I wanted to make sure we hadn't missed anything. They might know something or think about something in a way we hadn't thought about it. And it was always really helpful for us to get to hear their side of our case before we made that final step.
Well, a couple of other things about that. And obviously, a matter involving the former president of the United States is different. And maybe the hierarchy is different and the order of operations with respect to a meeting is different. But generally speaking, if the line prosecutors were thinking about indicting somebody and the defense lawyers wanted to make a presentation, I don't know how it worked in your office, but they couldn't come directly to me, right? They had to go through the process. They first would meet with the line prosecutors, and if the line prosecutors still wanted to indict, there would be a process by which maybe they would go to the supervisor, the criminal division chief, and only after at least one, if not two layers of review, if they still wanted to, they could meet with me as the U.S. attorney. Sometimes we would tell the party that, you know, this is the resolution we want, sometimes with respect to an entity. And we said, this is the penalty we're seeking, and this is the, you know, the bottom line of what we want in a resolution, including a guilty plea or at least a deferred prosecution agreement or something like that. And the defense lawyers would squawk about that. They would be told, well, if you want to meet further up the chain with the deputy U.S. attorney or the U.S. attorney, it's not necessarily the case that it will stay the same for you or get better for you. It could get worse for you. You ever have that?
I will confess that I would impose a trial tax if somebody came in the morning of trial when all of our witnesses had traveled and we were ready to go and wanted to plead that morning. But typically, we were a little bit less formal, maybe because we were a smaller office than y'all were, and would not necessarily do that sort of thing. But something that was non-negotiable in my office was you couldn't come and talk to the U.S. attorney about your case and bypass the line lawyers, the folks who were working the case and knew the case. You had to go to them and make that request. And then they would come to me and we would set up a time. We would have people in for coffee and cupcakes and hear everything that they wanted to say. But that had to be done in the presence of the trial team.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I think, you know, going back to another case involving Jeffrey Epstein out of the Southern District of Florida, the former U.S. attorney there, Alex Acosta, is reported to have met with lawyers for Jeffrey Epstein years ago and entered into a resolution without his trial team. And that's just a terrible look. In fact, you know, putting aside the formality of an actual meeting and a presentation, sometimes with a PowerPoint presentation alongside, sometimes lawyers would just call. And sometimes those lawyers might have a relationship with me. I never talked to them, or if I talked to them, it was only for a minute, because I thought it was important for the process to include the people on the ground, the line folks and their supervisors, who had investigated the case and were closer to all the facts, both because it made sense from a factual and legal standpoint, but also from a leadership perspective, right? You don't want it to look like the boss is, you know, taking calls from former colleagues or friends in a way that overrules what the line folks are trying to propose. I think it's a terrible look to do it otherwise.
I think that's right. It's respectful to do it that way. It's a credit to the public service that folks who are employees in U.S. attorneys' offices are doing. And honestly, they often knew the facts in better detail, richer detail, and could engage with the defense lawyers in ways that were super productive for us. But I want to go back to something that you flagged as you were talking about this process, because I think it's important, you said that in your office, you would sometimes float the beginnings of a plea deal, if only to use it as a hammer in the process.
No, I didn't mean, then I misspoke. Sometimes when you're talking about, so individuals are different from business organizations and companies.
Right.
Right. With an individual, we're talking about, we're going to indict or not indict. With a business organization, as you know, there are four possible outcomes when you investigate a company. One is to walk away. It's a declination. Another is a non-prosecution agreement, which is you don't charge, but maybe you have them voluntarily agree to some conditions like a monitor or some reforms or even a payment of a penalty. The third is a deferred prosecution agreement in which a criminal complaint is filed but held in abeyance until some conditions are met and they engage in some changes and maybe pay a penalty. And the fourth is full-on indictment, to which they maybe can take a plea or not. And with corporations, the decision was one of those four things. And you know, two of those four things are in the nature of a plea. And so that needs to be decided at the outset.
Right, absolutely. With individuals, it's an entirely different calculus. And these conversations can become an opportunity to talk about a plea. So my question for you is, do you think as Trump's lawyers visited with folks at DOJ yesterday, do you suppose that the topic of a possible guilty plea came up?
I don't think so. One, I think given what we know about Trump and his lawyers and their belligerence and their aggressiveness, their 100% goal is to avoid a charge, which also means avoiding pleading guilty to a charge, misdemeanor or otherwise. Second, you know, I'm back in private practice representing individuals and companies now. And I had occasion a few months ago to have my first opportunity to represent an individual who is being threatened with a potential federal criminal charge that I think absolutely should not happen. Not just because I'm the lawyer, but I actually think that's true. And I wouldn't have charged the case. And I wouldn't charge the case.
I love how you say it now that you're on the other side. Threatened with.
Threatened with. And as a general matter, if you're taking the position that your client hasn't done anything wrong, and it would be a miscarriage of justice to charge the person of any number of federal crimes. I think if you go into that meeting, particularly if you think you have a chance at a second bite at the apple, a second meeting, to even open up the dialogue about a possible plea weakens your position and gets the government thinking, well, they probably think that their client is guilty of something if they're even broaching the possibility of a plea, even if it's to something less than what the government wants to or intends to charge, don't you think?
Yeah, I definitely think it looks that way from the defendant's point of view. I think it's entirely unlikely that Trump has the Constitution to stand up in court and say he's pleading guilty because he is guilty and for no other reason. But by the same token, if you're the Justice Department, there's this interesting precedent that you probably have to live with from the Petraeus case. And then there's an earlier head of the CIA who's also prosecuted similar cases to Trump, retention of documents. And the plea that they're given is a misdemeanor and no time in prison. And I think that those decisions were very widely questioned when they were made, but likely reflected a couple of things. The fact that those defendants, if they were forced to go to trial, would have, of course, pulled out all the stops. And that could have meant a lot of spillage of documents that had classification levels or information about how the intelligence community worked that the government didn't want to have become public. And then also there's the problem of holding folks like that in custody and whether or not ultimately that becomes a national security risk at some point, just the prospect of having to hold them in custody. So that's an interesting situation to me. I think a plea is unlikely, but I do think DOJ, whether it likes it or not, has this precedent that suggests that that would be an outcome to consider on a plea unless they can distinguish Trump's conduct, which I, as a prosecutor, would certainly try to do, arguing it's much more egregious, the obstruction is much more egregious. And, you know, last week there was this conviction of a former employee who held on to classified material, who received 3 years of custody. And you know, you would think that that would be the better precedent. But a very interesting area to me, whether or not there will be plea conversations, given Trump's very unique character.
Yeah, for the reasons we've discussed, I don't think there will be. By the way, we should discuss, I don't know if it's interesting to people, what the nature and tone of meetings like this is. Contrary to what people might think, in my experience, they were never belligerent. There was no yelling. Bad idea to yell at the prosecutors. The most effective presentations were when you had sober-minded, reasonable defense lawyers who argued three things, right? They argued that the facts didn't meet the standard for prosecution, that there would be reasonable doubt and plenty of reasonable doubt, that the law didn't fit the conduct that was being alleged. And that even if the law and the facts were on the government's side, you would argue the interest of justice point. And there are, you know, a number of arguments for Trump's lawyers to make. I don't think they succeed at the end of the day. I think they can be distinguished. But the hot takes that we see in the press and from Trump's town hall and from his social media postings about how it would be unfair to charge him because Biden and Pence and other presidents have had classified information that they've mishandled or not handled properly. You know, there's a better version of that argument, which I think still ultimately fails, but it's not totally frivolous. And you imagine that argument being made. You imagine an argument about how important it is to be absolutely, absolutely, definitely sure and positive that there was misconduct and that it was egregious enough to go down this path for the first time in the history of the Republic, charging a former president, and that charge coming at someone who is likely to be the nominee of the opposing party to the sitting president and likely to be the sitting president's adversary in an election. Those are very weighty and mighty considerations. And I want people to understand that, you know, and I think that they are. Maybe they're overcome because on the other side of the coin is, you know, everyone is supposed to be treated equally, no matter whether they're running for president or some elected office or not. But those are not crazy arguments that I expect are going to be made or were made and made respectfully to the people in that room. And I'm guessing also the people in that room are taking those arguments seriously.
Absolutely. I mean, serious arguments made by serious lawyers are important considerations before a charging decision is made here. And I think you're doing a better job than I've heard any of Trump's lawyers on television certainly articulate the sort of factors that are at play here. In fact, the suggestion has been that their big argument is the FBI has engaged in misconduct. Prosecutors have engaged in misconduct. I don't expect any of that to fly, but there are prudential concerns here. As you pointed out earlier, you know, even if you get past the facts and the law, you have these questions about should you indict? And those are likely to predominate here. Although I would back up a step and say that it is not, you know, a given that the statutes apply to the conduct. It's great to look at what Trump's done. We can all agree as a matter of principle that it's misconduct, that no former president should ever handle classified material or national defense information in the way that Trump has. Whether you've got a statutory hook is an entirely different question. And each of the statutes that one, you know, suspects prosecutors are considering has sort of little hooks, little pegs that you've got to meet for that statute to apply. In some, it may be whether you can prove Trump had knowledge of certain matters or had a certain intent. You have to prove issues relating to the character of the documents in his possession. There are issues of you know, some of these documents. The Kim Jong-un letter, I do not think forms the basis for a charge because the existence of that letter was widely known and discussed. And it's tough to believe that a jury would convict if that's the charge against Trump. It would need to be something far more serious. So like you say, very good arguments for good lawyers to make in conversation with DOJ.
Last point about this meeting, and then we should talk about a couple of those statutes and some of the newly revealed evidence from reporting. But the least effective thing that lawyers could do, in my mind, or that in the experience that I've had, is when they come in with a particular attitude that's not respectful, but more importantly and more specifically, they say something like, you know what, if you bring this case, you're going to embarrass yourself and you're going to embarrass the office. And at that point, I'm like, F you, leave, get out of my office. This meeting is basically done. Don't tell me how to do my job and whether I will embarrass myself or not. Tell me about what you think the facts are and what the facts show and what the law provides. Otherwise, get the hell out. Fair?
Absolutely fair. I had one of those where they doubled down and I just got up and left. My own office. I got up and left.
You have, where did you go?
My office was, there was like a big office and an ante room and then a small office. And I just got up and walked through the little hall to the small office. I'm not proud of that moment, by the way, but it's like, you know, I mean, embarrassing the office. And this I think is a point that it's worth dwelling on. This is a big case for DOJ to take on. All the speculation, all the kidding aside, something has to be done to hold Trump accountable. DOJ is not the only possible venue for that. In 2020, at the polls, voters showed that they were capable of holding a politician who'd engaged in misconduct accountable. Yes, DOJ has to worry about doing it right. No, DOJ shouldn't act, you know, in an indiscriminate fashion just designed to please the public. But this notion of embarrassing the office by taking on a weighty, important matter and concluding that an indictment should be brought, I think is just silliness.
When I ran that office, I thought to the extent that the tone and the approach was earnestly saying, look, here's what you're not getting about this case. Here's what you're not getting about the facts and the law and what's fair and what's proper. It's just not the right thing to do. It's not the right thing to do for these reasons. And that kind of fair, honest, earnest presentation was the most effective to me, rather than a belligerent, you know, we're going to crush you in court, blah, 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 blah. That turned me off and was counterproductive for the client. Although some clients like that. You know, they maybe tell their lawyers to go in and be belligerent and scorched earth. There's a time for that. You can do that at court, although I think there are limitations to that principle also. But you're kind of at the mercy of the prosecutors, right? And prosecutors are people too. And you don't want to get their back up. And I like to think that even if someone came in and was belligerent and had a bad attitude, that at the end of the day, you make your decision based on the law and the facts and what the interests of justice require. But it's not a great approach. And I see people do that sometimes. I imagine that Mr. Trustee and the other lawyers were smart enough not to do that.
You know, one would think Jim Trustee spent a lot of time at DOJ. I think he knows Jack Smith, right? He was in a supervisory position when Jack Smith was running Public Integrity. So one suspects that they've known each other for a period of years and that this was a professional conversation among two serious lawyers, at least two.
Let's go back to this issue of who's going to make the decision. So Merrick Garland appointed Jack Smith to be the special counsel. And the special counsel has, as you will always see in the papers and in the reporting, you know, some autonomy, a bunch of autonomy, and he's making the principal decisions as an initial matter. But the buck still stops with Merrick Garland. If Jack Smith decides that an indictment is appropriate, he advises the attorney general. And the attorney general, notwithstanding the special counsel status of Jack Smith, has the option and the responsibility to either endorse that or overrule that, correct?
That's correct. He has reporting requirements to Congress if he does, but he has that authority.
So is it odd still that he wasn't at the meeting? Or does it mean that maybe there's a future meeting, a next step meeting as well?
There could be a next step meeting. He could get a briefing from Jack Smith. I think Merrick Garland has essentially said that so long as Smith's decision, and for that matter, the decision of other folks involved in these kinds of investigations, John Durham, as long as their decisions are within the mainstream of DOJ's practice, that he doesn't intend to intervene. And, you know, we saw that happen in the Durham investigation, where Durham brings these two prosecutions. Sussman is the first of them. And they are, I believe we called them marginal prosecutions when we discussed them on the podcast, suggesting that there was a likelihood that they would not succeed. Durham failed to convict in both cases, unusual step. Juries granted outright acquittals. But Garland had approved that action, or at least chose not to interfere with Durham's decision. I think that sets the bar for what we can expect to see with the special counsel. And based on the facts here and the law and DOJ's prior precedent, I think it's unlikely that Garland would interfere with a decision to prosecute.
So I think that's correct, but I'm going to distinguish two scenarios. I think if there's a decision to indict by Jack Smith, it is very unlikely, and if it's a reasonable one, very unlikely that Merrick Garland will step in and overrule that decision. Very unlikely. But not zero. If there's a decision not to prosecute, not to bring an indictment on the Mar-a-Lago documents against Donald Trump, I think there's zero chance that Merrick Garland will overrule that decision.
I agree with you 100%. He is not going to overrule a non-Prost decision.
So a couple of bits of evidence have come out we should talk about, which, you know, it's hard to know because we haven't seen it or heard it ourselves. There's a reporting about an audio recording from the summer of 2021 in which multiple people are talking to the press, which is interesting. And it sounds like people in the government, but it's not 100% certain, in which Trump sounds like he knows he has classified information and he wants to keep it. And it sounds fairly incriminating. What do you think about that?
You know, it's fascinating. For one thing, you're right to flag the fact that none of us have heard this tape. We don't actually know what's on it. But there's this very sort of catchy story that Trump is actually ruffling papers as though he has this document in his hand, which is reportedly a summary of how we might invade Iran. And he's telling the folks who are Mark Meadows' biographers, if I understand that correctly, he's telling them, I'd love to show this to you guys, but it's classified. I can't declassify it. I can't show it to you. Two different possible uses for this. This could be, if it's true, if that document actually exists, and some people that you and I, you know and value, Mary McCord, for one, our former DOJ colleague, have suggested that, consistent with Trump's pattern of lying, perhaps this document doesn't even exist. But let's just assume for the minute that it did exist. Well, that sounds like the sort of serious document that you might want to charge him with as a substantive matter if the intelligence community was okay with letting that become part of the evidence in this case. That, I think, depends on a lot of facts that we just don't know yet. But the perhaps more significant use of this tape, regardless of whether any of it is true, is helping the government establish Trump's state of mind, what he knew, the fact that he knew that he had stuff in his possession that was classified. They have other evidence that would establish that he knew he couldn't have it anymore, like four of his lawyers telling him that. And also, it indicates that he does not believe that he can magically declassify materials just by taking them out of the Oval Office. So this is a real interesting development.
Yes, it is. And then there's this other bit of evidence in which it's reported that Trump workers moved boxes in sort of what some people have referred to as a dress rehearsal. What does that mean? And is that vital evidence potentially as well?
Yeah, I think this term dress rehearsal comes from a sealed memorandum that District of Columbia Judge Beryl Howell wrote when she made her ruling that DOJ was entitled to get some materials that would otherwise have been protected by the attorney-client privilege. And since we haven't seen all of that memo, it's not entirely clear what she's referring to, but there is some suggestion, if you piece the evidence together, that Trump, assisted by his former, you know, government valet, Walt Nauta, that he arranged, once he knew that his lawyers were inviting DOJ in to reclaim their documents in June of 22, that he arranged to have those boxes taken out of storage, brought to him, that he went through them. Perhaps he removed some things. There is no direct evidence of that. I think that's the inference that for right now these stories are suggesting we might be able to draw. And then the boxes were returned before DOJ showed up. And so this is the suggestion that the lawyers were cuckolded, right? That they thought that they were turning things over to DOJ, and the lawyers actually didn't know that Trump had used his conversations with them to schedule this removal process. That is, I think, the working assumption of the theory on which Judge Howell permitted DOJ to pierce the attorney-client privilege with the crime fraud exception and get access to another new piece of evidence that we know about, which is Evan Corcoran, Trump's lawyer's impressions about the representation he had with Trump.
You know, I don't know why we're going through all this rigmarole necessarily, Joyce, because it's my understanding that there already is a prosecution memo which is in the public domain, not a prosecution memo done by people who are in the Justice Department or Jack Smith's team, but among other people. Oh, look at this. Joyce Vance, Andrew Weissman, Joshua Kolb, Norm Eisen, and others. Why'd you do a Pross memo?
You know, this was the product, and my name is on it, and I'm proud to have been a part of it. This was a team effort by a lot of people who looked exhaustively at putting together facts and law. And the whole reason to do this, and I think it's an important one, although I would encourage folks, if they want to look at it, it is well over 100 pages, and there's a pretty good executive summary up front. But the point of doing this is prosecutors go through this exercise of writing a Pross memo before they seek permission to indict a case. They lay out the facts. They lay out the law. They explain their analysis of why the facts ring the bell under the statutes. They consider potential defenses. They even consider, in some cases, DOJ's former precedent. And so we did it much more exhaustively than prosecutors would do it in a normal Pross memo in order to have some explanatory value for people in the public who wanted to play along but weren't necessarily familiar with all of these sorts of concerns. And I thought it was a telling exercise because in the process of doing this, it forced me to look at the case from Trump's lawyer's point of view. And that goes back to something that you said earlier. They have serious, non-frivolous arguments to make in this case. Some of those will surface if there is an indictment as possible defenses. There may be venue arguments or other arguments that are made. None of this is a gimme. None of this is easy for prosecutors.
So let's maybe spend a couple of minutes going through the two buckets of potential charges, because maybe we'll be setting the stage for a further discussion next week or soon, analyzing what actually does get charged, if anything does. So the first bucket, the first category, relates to the mishandling of government documents, and there are at least three statutes that are implicated there. And the second bucket is obstruction or making false statements, which relates to the cover-up of the mishandling of government documents. So as to the two of those, before we get into any nitty-gritty, and we can do that now or we can do that later, it's always been my assessment that the greater likelihood is one or more charges relating to obstruction as opposed to the mishandling of documents. There can be both. But if I had to pick, if you told me there are statutes being charged within one of the two categories, and I had to guess which, I would guess obstruction. Is that a fair guess?
You know, I think it is a fair guess. It's the weightier case in some ways. But I have a little bit of a feeling it's almost like a dry crime, right? I think here an indictment is more powerful.
It's just a process crime, Joyce.
I think that's the argument that Trump will make. And I like very much the idea of charging substantive counts and then the effort to obstruct. It just makes me a little bit happier.
So let's talk about the mishandling of government documents. We've said this before on the show, and maybe you want to put some meat on the bones since you did this 186-page Pross memo, that with respect to one or more of these statutes, the classification status of the documents is of no moment, is of no relevance. And one of those statutes is, of course, 18 U.S.C. Section 793, relating to the retention of national defense information for which, you know, ordinary people in the intelligence community or the military get charged with. Is that the most likely charge, you think, on the mishandling bucket?
It's clearly an available charge, and it's clearly a statute that DOJ charges in this sort of a situation. So I think it's likely. Here's a trivia question, though. How come this statute speaks in terms of national defense information and is not tied to the classification system?
Memory serves, and let's cut this out if I get it wrong.
I shouldn't have done that to you.
Professor Vance, that I think the statute was enacted before the modern classification regime.
Bingo. The statute.
There you go.
The statute is a World War I era statute.
Let's keep that in. Let's keep that in the show now.
Absolutely. So it talks about national defense information, not about classified information. And whether or not something is national defense information is a decision for the jury to make. It's a fact-based question for juries, not a legal decision. NDI has to be directly and reasonably connected to the United States national defense. It has to be closely held. Hence my thoughts about the Kim Jong-un letter. And some courts have even gone so far as to say that in order to qualify, disclosure of the documents or the information contained in the documents has to pose a threat to U.S. national security. So if DOJ charges that, something that the jury would be asked to decide is, whatever documents DOJ is charging, are they national defense information?
What about the other two? Concealing government records, conversion of government property. And usually the conversion of government property is not necessarily documents, but something else that is government property. And here would be the documents. And Trump has said again and again and again, mine, 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 and I have the right to do it, putting aside the declassification, changing story over time. Which of those other two you think is the more likely crime to be charged?
2071, which is just the pure retention of government documents claim, has some appeal. I think, somebody might want to check me on this, that the sentence for 2071 is lower, is not as serious as the Espionage Act statute. And sometimes prosecutors like to have that possibility of charging something that could be used for a plea. But I like the simplicity and the elegance of the theft of government property statute here. It's 18 U.S.C. 641. This is the way I think about this in my mind is that Trump is sort of like Gollum with the rings. You know, he's always talking about these documents. They're mine, my precious. He, at one point that the story goes, tries to convince his advisors that they should use the documents he has to negotiate with the National Archives for other documents that he wants. In the CNN town hall, he says, of course I kept this stuff. It was mine. I could do what I wanted to do with it. And all of this supports the core of the theft charge, which is that you took something that wasn't yours with the intent to hold on to it. So I think that's a pretty good charge here.
Okay. Then on the obstruction side?
So there are three possibilities that we consider in the Pross memo. One is the straight up obstruction of justice charge under 18 U.S. Code 1519. There's a criminal contempt charge for willfully disobeying the court order, the grand jury subpoena here, and then 1001 false statements to the government. I like the bookends here. I'm less bullish on contempt. I like straight up obstruction of justice. I think Trump's efforts to conceal the documents from DOJ and NARA ring the bells for that statute. And I am always a fan of the 1001 charge, the lying to the government charge. And I think this statement that Trump causes his lawyers to make to DOJ is a particularly good charge because if DOJ has the evidence to establish that he sort of schnookered the lawyers into making this false attestation, I think that's very powerful with a jury.
So, you know, I think this is a pretty good setting of the stage or setting of the table or whatever other metaphor you want to pick for potential charges. You and I were discussing before we hit the record button what we think about the timing, whether we think there's going to be more than one person charged. There's activity that we know about with a grand jury in DC. There's also activity we know about with a grand jury in Florida. I think you and I are both in agreement that the likelihood is that Trump will be charged in D.C. But there are these other people who are involved in the moving of sensitive information who could also be charged, maybe for the purpose of flipping them, maybe just to charge them outright, flatly. In Florida, there are some pundits, if we can call them that, in the last couple of days who have gone on television and elsewhere and said very flatly that there's going to be a charge this week. I'm not saying that. I don't think you're saying that. What do you make of that speculation?
Right. I'm a big believer in last minute exigencies. And, you know, no indictment is ever done until the grand jury votes for it and it's returned to the court. So maybe we'll see one this week, perhaps not. I suspect you did the same thing. I didn't always indict the big fish first in a case. Sometimes indictments came in waves as you tried to work up the chain and obtain cooperating witnesses. And sometimes there were just good reasons for indicting some lower-level participants first. Something that no one is really talking about here is a conspiracy. It sounds like there's not a conspiracy between Trump and his lawyers. It sounds like in some ways they were taken advantage of. Whether or not there's a conspiracy between Trump and some of these low-level workers, you know, we don't know, but there's not been a lot of talk about that. But if you were going to indict people like the maintenance worker who helped move documents around, if you can establish that they knew that the government was coming and that was why those documents were being moved, that's something that you might learn by taking evidence in front of a Florida grand jury. It's possible you might not have jurisdiction or good venue in the District of Columbia, or it might just make more sense to do it in Florida. that could explain, it's not the only explanation, but it could explain why we're seeing reports of grand jury activity in Florida. And so it could be that we'll see an indictment of somebody who is not Trump as the preamble to this case. Did I hedge my bets enough there?
Yeah, you did. You did fine. I think you did fine hedging. You know what I always say in circumstances like this, Joyce?
What's that?
Stay tuned. Although that's the wrong podcast, different podcast.
But so perfect here.
Let's spend a few minutes on the other thing we mentioned at the outset before we go. And obviously we'll be following on a daily basis, if not an hourly basis, what goes on in the developments in the Mar-a-Lago documents case. But this is a matter that I've gotten a lot of questions about, that if you're a lawyer, especially a practicing lawyer anywhere in the country, you know this story. People are talking about it. People are opining on it. People have their own views about this. And it's the intersection of the most popular and kind of interesting innovation topic in the world right now, artificial intelligence, generative AI, ChatGPT, and what we talk about all the time and what we're sort of, you know, pretend to be expert in, and that is the law. And if you haven't heard about it, just very quickly, it finally happened. We've talked a lot about situations where students in high school or middle school or in college even are submitting papers that have been written by ChatGPT, and there's concern about whether or not they'll be caught and what this does to the quality of writing, and is it plagiarism? All sorts of ethical issues relating to education and paper writing. Well, it's now happened in a court and in the Southern District of New York before Judge Castell, who I don't know if Judge Castell listens, but if you do, hey, Judge Castell, and I will say about him, he's a very smart, no-nonsense judge. And in a case over which he is presiding, a plaintiff claimed to have been injured on an airline flight on Avianca. And Avianca's lawyers, as their wont in cases like this, moves to dismiss the action, the tort, on, among other grounds, statute of limitations grounds. And the plaintiff writes a brief, and we can talk about what it means to write a brief and how they're constructed and who researches the cases and the law in the brief. The plaintiff wrote a brief filed in front of Judge Castell, citing to a number of cases, including six cases, that the defense couldn't find evidence that those six cases actually existed. And they came with case citations. And if you're not a lawyer, you should know that case citations are very specific and very sort of archaic. And you're supposed to be able to find them in reputable databases or on a library bookshelf somewhere, although nobody keeps hard copy books anymore, I don't believe. And upon query from the judge, the plaintiff's lawyer said, well, here's a list of the cases and here are excerpts from the cases. The defense folks still couldn't find the cases anywhere, and the court couldn't find the cases anywhere, and actually determined that one or more of the docket numbers assigned to the six cases in question, when they looked them up, or when they went to actually the clerk of the Ninth Circuit in one circumstance, it's a totally different case. And then it is revealed that the lawyer for the plaintiff queried ChatGPT for cases on point and wholesale cited to the cases with the descriptions of the cases provided by ChatGPT. But guess what? ChatGPT made them up out of whole cloth, completely fabricated and not checked. How much trouble is this lawyer in?
So much trouble. Just aside from the pure cringiness of this, you know, I think problems with the court, problems with the bar. I remember when I was in law school in the first year at UVA in our small sections, we took legal writing, and that class was taught not by professors, but by two third-year students. And one of them told us the story that was sort of the nightmare story that helped you always do the right thing as a young lawyer. She told us about a summer associate in their class who had done some research for a partner and who had failed to shepherdize a case. Talk about archaic. Pre-computer, I'm like really old. Pre-computer, you had to look up by hand to make sure that cases had not been reversed. And that process was called shepherdizing. And this poor young summer associate had failed to shepherdize a case that had been reversed, but had given it to the partner to use in a brief. Fortunately, the partner had shepherdized. No harm, no foul. But, you know, that was the moment, right? Always make sure that your cases haven't been reversed was the nightmare scenario for young lawyers. Now, I guess it's make sure that ChatGPT hasn't made up your cases out of whole cloth. I cannot contemplate doing this as a lawyer. I cannot contemplate the failure to sit down on Westlaw and do the research and find the best cases, not just real cases, but the best real cases, instead of asking artificial intelligence, hey, can you spin me up a couple of cases?
So I'm going to disagree with you a little bit.
I'm old school. That's what you're going to say.
No. And I'll tell you what I think the error was here. Well, a couple errors. First, ChatGPT is too nascent and is not designed to do this, number one. Number two, any brief that gets written that has a team of lawyers on it, I don't know how big the team was, but it sounds like there are at least two or three lawyers. Somebody has to do the research and other people review the work. I wrote a lot of briefs in my time, both in the U.S. Attorney's Office and as a private practicing lawyer. Sometimes it's the partner who double checks and gets, you know, I will often, even today, back in private practice, and not even in the context of necessarily a brief being filed in court, just a presentation to a client about sort of trends in the law, I'll ask for a binder of the cases and I'll have to see the actual cases. And if you have to go and find the cases, then you'll discover whether they're correct or not. And the fact that nobody ever looked at the actual cases in the proper place, even after they'd gotten the lead from ChatGPT, is utter malpractice and terrible. But the point I'm going to make is, I'm predicting to you that notwithstanding this wrinkle and this bump in the road and all the mockery being heaped on this lawyer, that artificial intelligence is going to become a very significant part of the practice of law, up to and including legal research and memo writing and brief writing. There's a startup company that there is a, which I'll not name, there is a line of law firms waiting to get a demonstration. But that's a generative AI tool that is specifically designed for lawyers and law firms and in-house counsel that I haven't seen the demonstration yet, but I'm fascinated by it, that eliminates these errors and doesn't fabricate things. But in 5 years, if we're still doing this program, a part of every law firm's practice, I predict, is going to be use of AI in the same way that they use Westlaw.
And I don't have any objection to that. I like technology. Just like Westlaw, a quick way of reviewing on a computer a case's history to make sure it's not been reversed has replaced shepherdizing. My hope is that that will take, you know, some of the routine out of legal work. But like you say, the importance of having specific legal focused sort of AI become available that will, for instance, hone in and know how to hone in, because there will have to be humans setting the parameters, right? They're looking at their individual case. And instead of perhaps writing search terms and reading through a Boolean search on Westlaw to find the most responsive cases, then AI is able to help them do that in a quicker way. It'll still take human beings to think through the connections and do some of the sophisticated reasoning. I don't have any problem with using technology as a shortcut to get there.
Yeah. All I'm saying is, to the extent there are people posting on social media or otherwise opining that, you know, the law is not ready for AI and AI is not going to play a role, that is just not true. It is playing a role today. It is playing a role today at places where, you know, first drafts of legal research that ordinarily are done by first and second year associates are being done credibly and capably, and in some ways better, by AI that's specifically designed for lawyers. I have a question for you just about how you would have handled this. So you're the defense lawyer for Avianca, and you're scratching your head because you're trying to look at these cases. That's the first thing, by the way, that the other side does. You get a brief, it cites cases, and the cases look like they're helpful to the plaintiff, and you're the defendant, and you want to look at them. And why do you look at them? You look at them because you're hoping that there's some mischaracterization of them, and they're not as helpful to the plaintiff as is being suggested in the brief. That happens all the time. And you go and you look at the case and you find other language than the language that's cited by the plaintiff to say, well, actually, this case that the plaintiff cites and relies upon is not quite as favorable to them as they say because of this other fact. Or, you know, maybe it's limited in some way, or maybe there's another case later. Maybe they didn't shepherdize. Maybe they didn't see if it was overruled. But the first step is the adversary goes and somebody pulls the cases and reads the cases and makes sure that they stand for the proposition that the plaintiff says they stand for. So you do this and you can't find them. You can't find the cases. Do you write to the court first? Or do you call the plaintiff's lawyer first and say, what the hell is going on?
You know, my lean is always to talk to the other lawyer first and just to say, is there a little problem here? And there are, you know, situations, not this situation, but other situations that you see come up in cases where you want to give that other lawyer the courtesy. I felt like the defense lawyers here handled this really well. They weren't accusatory. When they reached out to the court, they just sort of said, we can't find these cases. And that left the decision-making process up to the judge.
I guess we don't know if the defense called the plaintiff. That's just not, it's not on the record that I've seen. And there's nothing wrong with not doing that. And there's nothing wrong with doing that. They didn't have to gild the lily. when you have your adversary committing complete and utter malpractice in this way, all you do is just sort of flatly tell the court and let the court do his job. And, you know, I don't want to feel free to, but I don't want to speculate about what sanction there may be. It's a very serious thing. And, you know, in some ways, and maybe this will be controversial, I think it's ridiculous what the lawyer did, and I've used the word malpractice a few times. Don't sue me. But I feel a little bit, some part of me feels a little bit bad for the lawyer too. Is that wrong?
No, I have the same feeling. I mean, it was a really bad, unfortunate thing that they did. We don't know all the circumstances about how it came around. Maybe we're always more inclined to be sympathetic towards people who look a little bit like us, and we're lawyers, so lawyers look like us generically. But, you know, I hope this person doesn't get their ticket pulled to practice law. Certainly, they will be a more careful and a better lawyer in the future. However, for their specific client in this specific case, there are repercussions, and they need to be held accountable for that.
What's also a little bit crazy here, and maybe part of the reason I feel bad for the lawyers, maybe if you have no understanding of the deficiencies of ChatGPT in its current iteration, you can maybe be forgiven. I don't think so. But at first, when made aware that these cases didn't seem to exist anywhere, the plaintiff's lawyer went back to ChatGPT and basically said, are you lying? Are you lying? Are you a lying liar? Fibber. And ChatGPT says, like, no, I'm not lying at all. And that was taken at its word as well. And that ChatGPT actually manufactured portions of cases, but those cases still weren't able to be found on the traditional websites and platforms and databases. And so my question to you is, what's to prevent, I don't know how this works. I mean, people are beginning to talk about the doomsday scenarios that can arise from AI, and AI that can take action in the real world, not just provide information and spit stuff out, whether it's a poem or a graphic or a deep fake or a legal memo, but take real action in the real world, because a lot of action can be taken through computers. You know, there are websites that are not Westlaw, that are not paid subscription services. Cornell has one, some other places have them, that actually allow you to, for free, get full texts of actual decided Supreme Court, Circuit Court, and District Court cases. And I wonder if there will come a time where we have to worry that even if you go to a traditional free website, that a case you might find there is not actually an actual case, but something planted there by AI. And maybe there are safety protocols to prevent that, and that would require hacking. But I don't know that AI is that far off from hacking.
You know, I think we're already there, that you have to be concerned, that you've got to make sure that you source all of your stuff properly, whether it's legal documentation or not. I mean, this opens up that whole AI can of worms that is simultaneously promising and frightening for the future. But for the practice of law, I think it will require us to all be extra careful. Every lawyer is on notice about these risks because of this. And I was really interested in the reporting. I mean, when AI comes back and cover, you know, ChatGPT comes back and covers up its lies by saying, no, I'm not lying, it's sort of behaving like your average 14-year-old boy. No, I didn't sneak out and go to that party and, you know, smoke cigarettes. It's familiar behavior. The question is, what will the experts do to try to control that? And also in the reporting, there's this suggestion that ChatGPT has hallucinations from time to time. I'm not really sure what to make of that. Does that mean it will hallucinate more cases and try to hack, as you say? I mean, I really want to know more about this.
Yeah, I mean, smarter people than I have explained it, and we've been talking about it on the Stay Tuned podcast for a while, and we're going to be talking about it a lot more. But you know, people need to be reminded that this version of AI, this brand of AI, is not a problem-solving brand, right? That's why it's bad at math. There's a question that you can ask it. Somebody posted a question, which was, my biological mother, at the time I was born, my biological mother was in Paris and my father was in New York. Where was I born? Right? Which you would think something that seems as vastly intelligent and has had so much training on everything on the internet would be able to answer that question, but it's flummoxed. And on other occasions, when it doesn't have an answer, it makes stuff up. And the reason for that, it's not a calculator. It's not a problem-solving mechanism or tool. It's a large language model. So it's predicting what words should be used, what sentences should be put together in proper syntax to answer the query. And so something about that, that I'm not smart enough to understand, can cause it to make up words and make up things because it's searching for the right language. It's not necessarily searching for the truth, whatever that means. But we'll be back to you on that. So in any event, beware, lawyers, of using ChatGPT or any other AI product that's not approved by at least 4 out of 5 lawyers.
Do you think DOJ will be using it to draft potential indictments in the Mar-a-Lago case?
I believe not. I believe not. And DOJ is kind of cheap. And so to the extent that costs money for a subscription, I don't think so. Meanwhile, we'll be keeping an eye on the Mar-a-Lago case. Maybe we'll be speaking to all of you before next Tuesday, but if not, we'll see you here next Tuesday. As always, send us your questions, thoughts, comments to letters@cafe.com.
We'll look forward to answering them.
That's it for this week. Cafe Insider is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Joyce Vance. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The editorial producer is Jake Kaplan. The audio producer is Nat Wiener. And the Cafe team is David Tatasciore, Matthew Billy, Adam Waller, David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Namita Shah, Claudia Hernandez, and Sean Walsh. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.